Remaker's Mark, Episode 40, Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in Part 2 of Episode 40, where we are once again discussing Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you tonight? And what is your Kiss character? So which member are you like, or what new member would you be if you were to be a new member of KISS?
Fabulous. Shemp.
Once again, Andy's on repeat.
So he just cast himself in that role?
Hey-yo!
Nice. Creepy and nice. Good pick. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you, and what would your traditional and or KISS new character be? Oof, that was bad. Sorry. Carry on, then.
Yes. I'm good, and my KISS character would be akin to the old He-Man character, Manny Faces. Nice. So I would have three different makeup sets that would spin around.
One would that you is have like a knob on the top of your head,
right? And so one is kind of like normal guy, and then there's one that's sort of like angry guy, and then there's one that's like a beast man kind of thing.
Oh man, nice.
You know, one of them would be Orko, and you know it.
It doesn't even make sense. He didn't have a face.
Exactly.
Tila, you'd be Tila.
Oh,
good one.
Not Andy. Cool, dude. Good. Not cool.
Shut up.
Lee Hardluck Woman, how are you tonight? And what would your KISS character, current or new, be?
I'm great. And I think in terms of the actual band, I suppose I would aspire to be more like Ace without all the addiction problems. Mm-hmm. But I'm probably more like Gene because I'm as weird as he is.
Nice. Good, honest answer. I like that. Mark Schrosting, how are you, and what is your KISS character, old or new?
I'm well, thank you. And I would be a new KISS character. My KISS face paint would be a field of white, a black oval over one eye, and a little squiggly line coming out the bottom of the oval. And my name would be the Tadpole.
Nice. Because, I thought maybe you were going for Snoopy there.
I thought you were going for sperm.
Or Spuds McKenzie there for a minute.
No, get your mind out of the gutter and into the swamp, because it's a tadpole.
It's all open for interpretation. Yeah. It's because, the best part of a good KISS costume.
Yeah, and it's because squiggly also describes my guitar work.
There are a lot of squiggles.
My name is Kyle Delahunt. I will be your host once again this fine evening. And Jer, I'm sort of copping off your vibe, only I'm going to be like good cop, bad cop from the Lego movie, where it's sort of interchangeable, where like I have masks in the front and the back. And depending on how I'm feeling, I can kind of like turn it around. So it's like many faces, many being two.
Instead of three.
Yes.
And voiced by Liam Neeson.
Yes, exactly. Yep, that's my hope. Hey, if I could be voiced by Liam Neeson, all would be right with the world. I'm totally down with that.
That would be pretty sweet. That'd be a great superpower. Yep.
And how. Yes, indeed. All right, let us move on to our Remaker's Mark Recommends section. Mark, what is your recommendation for us this fine night?
Well, once again, I'm going back to the well of Marvel Heroes, which I think I've done exclusively. No, I haven't done that. Anyway, I've done a lot of that. I'm doing it again, so suck it. I am going to recommend Marvel's Daredevil on Netflix.
Nice.
Season 2 just dropped on March 18th, which was a couple of weeks ago as of this recording. But it's so good.
Yeah,
I mean, season 1 was great for being gritty and dark and really real. Like, as far as hero shows go, it has a very, very down-to-earth feel to it, which Daredevil should. But season 2 also features the Punisher, and his portrayal by Jonathan Bernthal of Walking Dead fame is also much more real than any other Punisher has felt. It's so good. You gotta watch it.
Yeah, I was one night I watched, Kate was out and it had just started. So I watched like three episodes in a row and she got home, I think with like 9 minutes to go or something like that in the third episode. And so I paused it and, you know, said hello and we chatted for a little bit. And I was like, do you mind if I finish watching this? She's like, no, go ahead. And the end of the third episode. So in the first season, there was a battle in a hallway, which was kind of like their go-to battle moment. I mean, it was just incredible the way it was filmed and just the choreography and everything.
Yeah, it was one shot.
Yeah, it was one shot. And this one was one shot. It started out in a hallway and then went down a stairwell. And the camera, like, I don't know how they did it. It was unbelievable. But yeah, so we watched that, and it was basically like a 9 minute battle. And Kate was like, what the hell was that? So she saw what is probably the best moment after not having seen any Daredevil at all of like the whole series. I was like, that was something else, man. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah.
I just put that on my queue to watch. So I'll get on that.
Did
right
you watch
away.
The? Did you watch the first season?
I haven't seen. No, I haven't seen any of it.
Okay. Yeah, you should. You definitely should.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Really good.
Is it nice? Better or worse than Flash?
I haven't watched Flash, so I don't know.
I would say it depends on your palate, but mostly much, much better. The Flash is really good, but it's a CW show, and so you know what you're going to get.
What
you
about
know, you get
the,
lots of teen drama.
Aw, but I love teen drama.
Then it's right up your alley.
What was the other Marvel Netflix original?
Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones.
Which is also very good. That was one of Lee's recommendations recently.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's quite episode. Gritty.
Yeah. Yep. They're gritty in different ways, but definitely like hard PG-13 probably are. Actually, Daredevil is most certainly are. Jessica Jones is right on the edge, but Daredevil is pretty violent.
I'd say Jessica Jones is a pretty solid R.
Yeah, I think so too.
And they
yeah.
they both take place in Hell's Kitchen too, right?
They
yep.
do.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. Cool.
And
good recommendation, Mark.
I like Fist. It.
Yeah, it's got so much good stuff coming.
Mm-hmm.
Well, normally we would move on to the feedback section here, but because this movie is so bizarre and so I think mostly unknown, and there's literally no way to get a copy of it. Thankfully, Mark had a copy that he shared with us, but there's basically like. Even if we put it out there like, hey, you should probably go see this. I don't know how anyone could. So we got no Facebook and Twitter feedback, but that's okay. We'll maybe throw it out there. And maybe after this episode, someone will be like, oh, my God, I would have had 1,000 words to say about it.
I did find a version of it on YouTube.
Oh, really?
Yep.
What? Really?
Oh, well, heck, I had no idea.
So I would have thought the only way to get a copy would be to eBay it.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yep. Yep, nothing easy, for sure. And probably nothing that broke laws or didn't break laws, as Kiss would have it. All right, and then let's do a quick recap of the casting from the first portion. So we had one major character, that being the whole damn band of Kiss. And the winner for that was my pick of Japanese metal pop band Baby Metal. You should all check them out. They are fantastic, and I'm super excited that they would be in this movie, were it only to actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the minor characters, the winner was Mark's choice of Tilda Swinton for the villain of the film, Abner Devereaux, in all her creepy, creepy glory.
Yay.
Nice. Yay. And I think she could, you know, she would have been great with Slipknot, but she'd be just as good under the reign of Baby Metal. So,
agreed.
Yeah. In like Flynn. I said the big winner there is Kiss, just because they're still playing and making gajillions of dollars. That's got to be something. So, Andy, you're up next in the alphabetical order. What is your pick? So, once again, we've been doing this the last couple times where we did not – normally we discuss this in between, but we have not talked about this. So, this is going to be a surprise to all of us except for Andy. Andy, what is our next film going to be?
Gentlemen, buckle up. This one's going to be a long ride. We're going to go all the way back to 1939.
Wow.
We're going to watch Gone with the Wind.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
holy cow.
All 3 hours and 58 minutes of it.
Oh. Is it only that long?
Wow.
It is only 4 hours long.
I watched it in college, and I remember thinking, when is this thing over?
There's an actual intermission in the middle, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I'm sure there's at least one. This is a movie that my sisters watched repeatedly when I was a kid.
What? Really?
And they just loved it.
How did they find the time?
Apparently, they didn't have much to do.
Nothing says party like Gone with the Wind.
And so, if I wanted to watch TV, I had to watch what my older sisters were watching, which was Gone with the Wind. So I feel like I've seen this movie many, many times, but only as a young child. So I haven't seen it in decades. So I'm excited to actually look at it with, I think, with an adult critique and see how this thing fares.
Yeah, and it will be nice to get back to an actual piece of cinema.
Yeah, and I thought it would be a nice left turn from Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Opera. Park. Opera Park.
That's the sequel to Phantom of the Park, Phantom of the Opera. Nice.
Kiss somehow covers even worse. Phantom of the Opera. Oh, that somehow, would be awesome when Kiss covered Phantom of the Opera.
Actually, Paul Stanley did Phantom of the Opera on Broadway.
Really?
He did?
Yeah, wow.
Yep.
He's there, the Phantom of the Opera.
Was he Christine?
Yes. Always. Oh, God. That's terrifying. All right. Gone with the Wind. I'm in. I'm down. I'm totally down. Wow. That's going to be like a three-phaser,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I anticipate. Maybe a two-phaser.
It's a movie that should have been a miniseries, but before they knew what miniseries were.
That's true. They only had 4-hour reels of film, and they're like, well, we can't do anything other than just fill the whole damn thing.
They're like, we still got more film. We got to make more scenes. We got to fill this damn thing up.
Like, keep shooting. I bought the damn thing.
Oh, Lordy. Oh, nice. All right. So off of Gone with the Wind, we return to Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. The first bullet point of discussion here is simply titled, "This was a hot mess / why does this exist?" question mark. So we're going to start it off there. This was rough. Andy, would you like to read your line here
verbatim?
That? Verbatim, please. Yes.
The whole thing or just that first
just the first paragraph, right. Yeah.
This movie was worse than Supergirl. Worse than the Star Wars Holiday Special.
Wrong.
Worse than the diarrhea I've had for the last week.
I can't qualify that one, but
you can speak to two of those three things. This was a rough one.
At the time when I wrote that, I was having some gastric distress. I'm better now. Thank you.
Yeah. I would submit that.
However, I stand by my comments.
I would submit that that of those three, Supergirl probably stands on top. I think it would be a toss up with the Star Wars Holiday Special. It might just depend on your palate. I mean, one of them you expect to be funny and stays funny, and the other one you expect to be funny and then it just makes you sad.
Again, which one?
For me,
you pick.
For me, the latter is Star Wars.
Yeah. I don't feel like this could tarnish anything. Like, Kiss was already Kiss. Like, they were already pretty weird and pretty out there. Like, they weren't serious enough to have anything tarnished. And I guess Star Wars really shouldn't have been, but enough people were invested in it that the holiday special. And that was after the first one, right? I mean, it was in between New Hope and Empire. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, imagine you're waiting for, I mean, I guess we kind of got it with The Phantom Menace, so The Phantom Menace wasn't quite a holiday special bad. But imagine that you were just waiting for anything Star Wars, and then the one thing that comes out is that. It's like, wow.
Yeah. And I think that's
what just happened.
It's especially bad in retrospect. You know, like that, you know, we all were, you know, were little ones, you know, growing up with Star Wars, and then came back to discover the holiday special.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, after going through the whole original trilogy, the holiday special is just it's just taking a big dump on your dreams.
Yep.
I'll defend it more than you guys will, but it's they're in the same catalog at the library. They're
there isn't a letter of the alphabet low enough to list these kind of movies. It's not B list, C list, or D list, or anything.
Q list.
I really think that both the holiday special and Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Opera or whatever. I think they're both both things that can only and at this point should only be watched in community and probably a little drunk.
Well, that goes to the kind of the second half of my my intro point was that I watched this movie alone, And that was just, it really was not enjoyable. There was nothing about that experience that was redeemable to me. And I didn't want to go off on a big rant about how much I disliked the experience of it, but it also made me realize that, yeah, this would have been a lot more entertaining seeing this in a group of people and probably more than a little drunk. I don't know. I guess I wanted to bring up the point about talking about the how people like to enjoy bad films sometimes, but I don't know. This one wasn't that for me. It was just, it almost made me, like, I had almost had a visceral, angry reaction at this. And I was like, wow, this is, I'm really getting upset about this and I don't understand why. And it's
because it takes too many liberties with the term campy.
It takes up too many of my, of like my precious, precious heartbeats that I have left in this world. And I knew I was never getting that time back, even with Supergirl, which I did not enjoy, but at least with that, there was something about that was more redeemable than this. I don't know what it was yet, but.
Can I take a moment to poke at you with the psychologist cattle prod?
Please.
Which comes standard issue with the diploma.
Please do.
I'm going to suggest that that such distaste as you experienced from Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park stemmed from the fact that it was not your choice to watch it. I asked you to.
You did, and you weren't here with me.
When it becomes an assignment, it's a little tough.
But I think you're right, Mark. I think that was a part of it. But I also think that had we all been together to watch this, I would have enjoyed it immeasurably more.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
This would be a very different discussion, I think, had we all gotten together and watched this.
Yeah, I think so.
As a group.
And you know, and we've.
I wanted to say exponentially more, but there's not. You can't say exponentially more than zero. I think you actually have to start with a number.
You can say exponentially, but not more. And you know, I think we've gone on record on this podcast before, determining that I am the sponsor in the sponsor comedy genre, and. I'm that guy that will sit down by myself and watch these movies and just laugh and laugh and laugh. And that's what this one was for me, is that those times when you go on YouTube and you watch videos of people falling down or of that wreck on the NASCAR track and parts just fly over and it's just a streak of fire down the track and you find perverse humor in it. You know, that's what I do with this movie. And I laugh at others' misfortune. That's my hobby. My favorite thing to do.
I should point out that Ace Frehley was quoted as saying that when the first time he watched this, he couldn't stop laughing throughout the whole thing. And I mean, he could have been. It's probably because he was drunk and mm-hmm. or high. But yeah, he thought it was funny.
I kind of get that feeling from him watching the film
that
he just thought it was funny the whole time. And he kept making this sound. Eh.
Yeah. So weird. Yeah. I think the moment that, and it happened really early on, after the credit sequence was like footage of Kiss performing dramatically, not that they perform undramatically, but performing especially dramatically, laid over shots of like amusement park stuff. So people on roller coasters. And then like at the end of it, and I don't know if they did this on purpose or if it was just really shoddy filmmaking. It could be either direction equally well. It's Gene Simmons is the last one. And he looks to step off of a stage. And it looked like they just ran the film for like 6 seconds too long and just left it in there. So it looked like he was standing up on a stage and then like stepped off it. Now, I don't know if that was him supposed to be looking like he was like stepping down the roller coaster or something. But I was like, wow, that was bad. And so just in that moment, I was set for like, okay, this is going to be bad. You know what I mean? Like, even though we prefaced it in our last, you know, in our initial discussion of it, that it was not going to be great. You know, we knew what we were getting into, but that was like, all right, this is going to be pretty rough. But in a way that I'm like, all right, I'm cool with that. I'm game. So I think you just had to have the mindset, but it's not always easy, even when you have the mindset, as Andy's reaction would would show.
There used to be an old soap opera on TV called Dark Shadows back in the late 60s, early 70s, for about 5 years, I think. So as a soap opera, it runs every day, you know, 5 days a week, half hour long episodes or whatever it was. And it was terrible. And you would see shadows of boom mics or every once in a while, a camera pulling out of the frame as they switched from one camera to another. You'd see the camera on the dolly getting wheeled away or a grip in the background, like, oh, and then like duck out of film. I mean, they were just awful, but we would buy them on eBay and sets, you know, there was 28 sets of them or whatever. And we would just watch them and it was high entertainment because they were so terrible and the storylines were awful. And you would see the actors mess up lines but keep on going or look around for where their mark on the floor was. And that's what this was for me. And as far as you guys know, I actually watched all of it. But there was one moment where, and I love the fact that half the time the members of KISS are very obviously not the members of KISS, but they're stunt doubles, and they don't even try to hide the fact that they're not KISS at all. But there's one point where Gene Simmons, there is some kind of fight scene, and Gene Simmons grabs a guy and sort of throws him gingerly, like throws him away, and then a different part of the fight scene kind of comes into frame with some guy doing a cartwheel or whatever, and Gene Simmons just sort of takes five steps back and he's sort of looking at the ground looking for where he's supposed to stop walking, and it's just it's so terrible. It's nobody was trying in this movie besides, and I want to believe KISS was trying, they just aren't good actors because that's not what they're supposed to be. But nobody else really gave two craps about this made-for-TV movie that they were putting together. And it was Hanna-Barbera, wasn't it? Slapdash, this whole thing. Yeah, it was like, well, we'll just make some takes and, you know, whatever the best one was, we'll just use it. That'll be fine.
Yeah, we'll fix it in post.
Famous last words.
And post never came.
Andy, you had a worthwhile question that we should discuss here, which was this a spoof or was it a vanity project or a promotion? So do you want to talk a little bit about that and we can discuss as well?
Well, sure. And I think to begin with, this movie to me felt like it was a spoof of something, but I couldn't figure out what it was spoofing unless it really was trying to spoof like a Scooby-Doo episode, like a live action version of that. But I really just wonder what was the point of this movie? Was it simply a promotional stunt from KISS? Was this simply, which I wouldn't put it past them to do. And I mean, if it was, it was a brilliant move if you think about it, because they're still kind of talking about it and any press is good press. So was that the point of this, or was this actually concocted to be a genuine artistic endeavor? I really don't know. I'm curious if anyone has any insight into that.
I can answer that.
Please do.
Yes, this was 100% a promotional stunt, but it wasn't their idea. Their management was approached by a producer with this idea because in 1976, their popularity kind of exploded when Alive was released. And this was, it was just going up from there. And this was nearing the height of their popularity. They kind of peaked in 1979. And like the sets and the costumes and everything kept on getting bigger and bigger. And this was just part of it. Like they wanted something that would just get them out there to a wider audience. And being on TV was about the only way they could do that. And like, just to give you an idea of some of the other promotional things that they did, there was a KISS comic book in the 70s that the members did this promotional thing where they had blood drawn and they all dumped their blood into the red ink. And that was, you know, the news cameras were there and everything. And it gives you an idea of, you know, of what they did in terms of, you know, self-promotion and how far they were willing to go. But yeah, this was just part of that whole publicity machine.
Good info.
Thanks, Lee.
You're welcome.
Yeah, resident KISS expert. Good job. Mark, you had a good question here, which we talked a little bit about it in part one, or we sort of formulated our casting around that. But what do you think that there is a better version of this in terms of whether Kiss should be replaced by another band or actors and actresses, or what do you think? So you went the band side. Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you did that and what went into that discussion and what if you think that's the best move?
Yeah, the short answer is I don't know. I did mention in our episode one when we talked about the my history with this one and why I picked it that I do think this film does something really, really unique in Hollywood. And there aren't a lot of other films that try to do the same thing with the main role being an actual person, a fictionalized account, yes, but an actual person. You know, whether or not it worked in this movie, I could say no. Is there anything else that would have worked with Kiss in the leading role? I don't know. I think in our casting, we explored a lot of different options, and I think they're all fantastic. And I think that replacing Kiss in the remake with another band probably depends on the band. I don't know if I would want to do like Taylor Swift meets the Phantom of the Park.
Now that I would watch.
I would probably watch it. But then again, I watched this movie too. So I don't know. I wrote that question down mostly to prompt some of our casting decisions just to see like what's a good direction to take the remake? Because, you know, this remaking this movie is wide open with possibilities. It's just everything was wrong in the original, and so every remake decision would be more right.
I'm just wondering, could a band salvage this, right? So could a band be good enough performers to make it okay? You know what I mean? Like, or do you think only actors and actresses could do that? I mean, I think a band could be interesting and I think they could bring a lot to it. And the performance side of it certainly would be interesting. I would like that to do it a lot more musically. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if a band could ever not perform so badly that it would be a joke, you know?
Yeah. I have to wonder. I mean, I made a joke about Taylor Swift, but I want to think that she's a better actress than a singer. Although maybe that movie Valentine's Day disproves it. I think it might depend on the band. There are plenty of musicians that are also good actors, and it might also fall in the hands of the director, which the original film didn't have apparently. But yeah, where this question should have gone is does it ruin the spirit of the film to try to do something other than have a band be themselves in the movie?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way to put that.
Is there a spirit of this film?
I think there is.
I mean, if this is largely just a commercialization vehicle for a band, what else is the movie then?
I think you could say what you wish the spirit was or what it could be, you know, sort of fun, playful, an homage to haunted house movies, an homage to Scooby-Doo, an homage to horror movies. You know, I mean, there could be a lot of different things, and it does a equally poor job of all of it, except for maybe the Scooby-Doo part. And that was not that great to begin with, but yeah.
Take out the fact that there's a band playing in it, or even make it a fictional band, make it four people who are starting a band or are in a fake band, let's call them Sloshy, and they are hired to play a gig at a haunted house, which turns out to be overrun by robots and a mad scientist. Like, is that a good movie that should be made right now?
I would say that it certainly could be a good movie. I mean,
it could definitely be made because Hollywood makes a lot of iffy plot movies. And it's certainly a better plot than some of the other movies that I've seen come out lately.
Yeah, I would come back to something like Cabin in the Woods, where if you look at it just as how you describe it, it just sounds like a meta view of horror movie tropes that makes another horror movie. But in execution, it was wholly different and incredibly well done and mm-hmm. really good and had good scares, had good laughs. So I think like that's the kind of movie that you should aspire to with this. It's something that takes those sort of core elements of all those different things and then just blends them together into something that's new and unique and pretty fun.
I think it would be really interesting to see a movie that was a live action retelling of a Scooby-Doo type plot that wasn't hokey. that was a serious project.
Yeah.
I think that's a good call. That would be interesting. And have all of the elements of a Scooby-Doo episode or a Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park episode but make it a serious suspense drama.
I'm sure there's something that exists, but it would take some digging. I could illustrate on a tangent and ask this question. If you take the movie Yellow Submarine and you replace the Beatles with a fictional band, does it have the same weight?
I would say no.
I didn't like it, so I can't speak to it.
And I've never seen it.
But if you take a,
I actually haven't seen
if you take a movie like Across the Universe, which came out a few years ago, which was in a similar vein to that, it was entirely Beatles songs, but not about the Beatles at all. It just happened to be telling a love story set in the 60s through Beatles music, but it wasn't about the Beatles at all. That was a very clever and very well told story that I enjoyed quite a bit. And it focused on the Beatles music, but not the Beatles themselves. And I think something similar to this could be done, even with Kiss music. It could be a movie about some people solving a mystery at a haunted park via the songs of Kiss, without necessarily being about Kiss.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I like that idea too.
Lee, you had a comment here about wanting something to do like really dark horror-y. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I was wondering if it would be more interesting to make a movie like this a little darker and a little more serious and not quite as campy, I guess. I didn't know about having the superpowers or anything like that, but maybe just having a straight up murder mystery where the main characters just happen to be in a band or something similar to that. I was also thinking, like, when you guys were talking about the example of, like, Yellow Submarine without the Beatles and a different band in there. Has anybody seen the movie Light of Day?
Uh-uh.
Came out in, like, the 80s. Mm-hmm. It was starring Joan Jett and Michael J. Fox. They were brother and sister, and they were in a band.
Huh. No, I've not heard of that.
Oh.
That is an odd combo.
It didn't do very well. But I was thinking, and it's just like a straight drama about these two just trying to figure out what they want. One of them wants to be like a big rock star. The other one just kind of wants a normal life, but they're still in this band. And I was wondering, like, what happens if you take a story like that and put an actual real band in it? Because the band in it is fictional, but like, what happens if you, you know, tell that story, but with Aerosmith in the lead roles.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think something like this could be a little bit more interesting if it was darker and not quite as silly, but I don't know what that would look like exactly.
Well, the action scenes are full of potential for that. I mean, like the first scene, where the kind of gang of hoodlums is inside the haunted mansion thing,
yeah,
you know, that set, like that was, there were a couple moments in there that were like genuinely freaky. And so like that set a decent precedent, and then it just went downhill from there. So I think they kind of blew their action wad in that first scene, or it just so happened that that's where the next big action scene was going to be, or that's where kind of the main one was.
Yeah.
But there were some decent scares in there, and it had a lot of potential for that. So I think, you know, having it be genuinely creepy and genuinely scary would be really good. I think that the potential for that was there. It just didn't execute on it for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's one of the, well, no, that's the only way that I can see to turn this into a serious movie is to have it be scary.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise I think you would need to go full campy with it.
Yep. And that's kind of the other end of the spectrum is realize how silly it is. And go, man, I don't even know. I can't think of something that's that campy. I mean, I think like when I think camp right now, I think of kind of Wet Hot American Summer, like that sort of vibe. But that has nothing to do with this. I mean, that's pretty different. So I don't know. I mean, has there been a good campy horror movie? I mean, Scream had the potential for that. But was still really scary at the same time. It was just self-referential. Has there been a good campy, scary horror movie?
I think there are plenty of horror movies that are both good and campy.
Yeah. I think Return of the Living Dead is pretty campy and pretty, it's actually, you know, kind of an interesting movie.
Yeah, I guess the Evil Dead series is probably pretty close.
Well, and look at a couple of the different zombie movies that have come out recently that are like Zombieland is pretty campy.
Yeah.
And I can't think of
the other Warm one. Bodies?
Well, yeah, to a point. I mean, that one was...
I bet you're thinking of Shaun of the Dead.
That's a good one, yep. It's not super high on scares, but it's definitely a quote-unquote horror movie. But even all of those three from that trilogy, Hot Fuzz and End of the World? What is the last one called?
The World's End.
World's End,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all three of those could fall in line with what this could be.
Yeah, that's a good call. And those are also just really good action movies, too. That's, I think, what's really set them apart.
There was one movie that I was thinking of that that I think falls nicely in this this compromise between camp and horror. Okay, more campy. But I don't know if you guys have seen the movie My Name is Bruce. This is an interesting one because it actually does the same thing where it stars Bruce Campbell as Bruce Campbell.
Oh, yes, I did see that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a fictionalized version of himself where he's basically a down on his luck actor, and he's living in a trailer, but he is his own identity of Bruce Campbell, and he essentially gets hired by the residents of this town to rid them of an ancient evil. It is definitely campy horror. And there are some decent scares though, and I think that movie should probably be the totem for what a modern version of Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park could be. It's fun, but it's at least a little bit scary. It doesn't make you hate yourself for watching it.
That's something to be said. Something that you would not be able to say for this necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that should be a bar for every film being produced, but clearly it wasn't for some films.
Mm-hmm. One question that I had, and Lee, you mentioned it briefly, but the sort of supernatural talisman thing. So in the original movie, Kiss has superpowers, kind of. But they're driven by this briefcase full of figures or, I guess, talismans is the best way to put it.
Yeah. Maybe medallions?
Yeah, mini medallions that provide their various, powers and personalities, what have you. So my question was, one, I think, well, I guess this isn't a question, this is a statement. One, I think we should do away with that because that was really weird and not at all helpful. And the special effects were terrible. But two, was that part of, like, Kiss's mythology, like, that talked about, that was their origin story all along? And Lee, sounds like you had an idea about that.
Yeah, I think that just kind of went along with their public persona, just sort of the mystery around who they really were. Because from like 1975 to about 1982, they were never photographed or very rarely ever photographed without their makeup on. And oftentimes they could just go out in public without their makeup on in street clothes and nobody would recognize them. And it was, the perfect disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Gene Simmons has a story of, like, in 1977, they were doing a concert at an arena, and he showed up late for some reason, and he wasn't able to get backstage right away, so he just went to the ticket counter, bought a ticket, and then walked backstage, and nobody knew it was him. So I think this was, those outrageous personalities for their characters was just... a way of ramping up that public persona or the mystery around, who they really were, because nobody knew except for maybe friends and relatives for all that time. So that aspect of the movie actually kind of made sense for who the band was.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I just wish it wasn't so poorly executed.
Yeah.
It could be cool. Yeah. And if it's part of the mythology, like I dig that, I guess, but it was just really bad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Bad force field, bad, like eye laser shots and Gene Simmons scream special effects and yeah.
That's really weird. That fire breathing thing that he did, that is like the poorest, that is like the worst special effect I've ever seen of fire. It looked like it was just animation.
Yeah.
It was just terrible.
It's pretty much just like Godzilla, but Kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, I can't get away from, I think it's Paul Stanley's Starman's power, like the shoots a laser out of his eye or something. And it's just a dotted line.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he kind of has like the power of persuasion too. When he sort of overcomes Melissa, like, you know, she sees him and he like can predict the future, or he can see what, I don't know.
I think he can read minds by doing that. And he can also like hear things that are far away. Cause when he eavesdrops on their conversation,
that's right.
It's like, okay, with your eye, you can hear with your eye.
It's amazing. That's a very special eye.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Talismans are in. I'm sold on it. I like it. Mark, you had a very good point about movies starring celebs as themselves, and you've already referenced My Name is Bruce. We kind of came up with some other ones here. So Yellow Submarine, you talked about. Who put Scooby-Doo in there?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I wrote all those.
Is that from the – oh, you put all those. Okay, so is that in terms of the celebrity hosts or guests, excuse me?
What I was keying in on was the idea of celebrities playing themselves in leading roles, really having more than a cameo. And even though the celebrities that were on Scooby-Doo were there as guest roles, I mean, they were there for the entire episode. I can't think of a single one that didn't see the mystery through to the end. But even then, they're only there for a half hour. So weaker example, but I do think it's an interesting case. The others I thought of were a little bit tangential to the spirit of this film. Like there was an interesting movie a few years back called This is the End. And it was basically on an ensemble cast of most of the most famous comedians these days. And they were all basically themselves. Some of them decided to take on a different personality. Like, I think Michael Cera was just a big jerk. I didn't actually see it, but I, you know, did seen interviews and stuff.
Yeah. I remember seeing the trailer. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. You know, you got your Jay Baruchel and your Seth Rogen and your, you know, what have you, and you name them, but all sorts of people in there. Aziz Ansari is in there.
Craig Robinson.
Yeah, lots of people just as themselves. And I think it's a very interesting concept. And I do think that group of actors in particular, basically just, they have the chutzpah to do it. They didn't care what anybody thought of them take on these weird personalities.
Yeah.
That sort of are just themselves.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to, we talked about this a little bit in Romancing the Stone. Sorry, Jewel of the Nile? Which one do we do? Romancing the Stone. About how it very much felt like a vanity project for Michael Douglas. Like, he executive produced it. Like, you can tell that it was probably something that he really wanted to do. Like, he wanted to make his Raiders. So, you know, I'm sure this was, it sounds like it was somewhat disconnected from Kiss, but it does feel like a vanity project. This is the End, I think, is the same thing. I'm sure, you know, Seth Rogen produced it and said, like, I want to make a movie with all my buddies and it's going to be dumb and hilarious because we're dumb and hilarious, right? Like, sometimes vanity can be said in a way that is positive and that it's, you know, something impassioned and something that's close to your heart. And sometimes it's just like, what you want to do in spite of what everybody tells you to do, right? So I feel like the original of this sort of skewed closer to the second side of that. But, you know, it could be really interesting if you get a combination of a band doing what they think they should or are actors doing what you think they should. I mean, like, you know, something like Tommy, you know, I mean, that was – it's not an extraordinary film, but it's a good film. It's interesting. It's got good music, you know, and I would very much call that a passion project or a vanity project for them. You know, there's lots of different things that have succeeded for that, but certainly not everything.
Let's not forget my favorite celebrity playing themselves in a movie being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
I thought about that one, too.
Nice.
There was one that I thought of, which is an interesting example of a more serious tone in a movie like this. There's a film called Paper Heart, and it kind of takes the form of a documentary, but it follows It follows a fictional relationship between two real actors, Michael Cera and Charlene Yi. And they're both comedians. You probably know Michael Cera, but the camera follows them around as they start dating. That's kind of, it's fictional, but, you know, it seems very real. And it's just kind of, that's the whole movie. And it's very subtle and it's entertaining, but it's also not campy at all. And I think it really works, but you might also have to have a taste for it.
Interesting. I remember the title, but I don't remember anything about it. So that intrigues me.
It's an interesting watch. I think you have to have some endurance for it, but I think it's pretty rewarding too. I mentioned a couple other things in our notes that there's an interesting one I haven't seen, but Jean-Claude Van Damme did one called JCVD, which is kind of a My Name is Bruce sort of thing, except I think it's supposed to be serious and not campy, but he basically plays a down-on-his-luck actor. I don't think it's supposed to be literally himself, but it basically is.
Right.
Like, he was a former action star, is kind of washed up.
Yep.
The last one I noticed is just sort of interesting, but there was a comedy series for a while called Are You There, Chelsea? It was a Chelsea Handler project, and she's in it, but she doesn't play herself. Laura Prepon plays Chelsea.
Oh, that's cool.
And Chelsea Handler plays Chelsea Handler's sister, Sloane.
Huh.
But, yeah, so, I mean, it's hardly related to Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, but it's a but it's a weird example of the celebrity playing being in their own project.
Sure.
With their own identity being the project too.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I think that wraps it up for the second half of our discussion of Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park and all for that movie. I can't say that I'm sad to be done with it, but you know what? This was fun. This was a good time. I enjoyed it. Good work, everybody.
Much like an amusement park ride, it was interesting, but we're glad it's short.
And then I threw up. Nice. Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you can find show notes for this episode and all of the other podcasts that we have there, including links for the actors, actresses, movies, and just things that we discussed here in this episode. That is also attached to the podcast file that you are listening to right now. You can find us on both Twitter and Facebook at username MathIsHardNet, so definitely follow us there and let us know what you think of our picks, movies, everything. Our next episode will be released on May 9th with our discussion of Gone with the Wind, so good thing we got about a month to manage that. we're gonna need it. And then after that, we're going to be starting a new series called Hidden Gems, where we are going to be, speaking of sponsor movies, we are each going to be bringing a movie that we enjoy that we don't think our other co-hosts have seen. So Andy is going to be doing the first one of those. Andy, do you want to give a little tease about what movie you are picking for that?
Sure. I'm assuming you don't want me to tell the title right now?
No, go for it. You certainly can.
Oh,
it's a very obvious tease.
So less of a tease and more of just a reveal.
Yeah, we'll do a reveal and we'll just say a little bit more about it as we get closer. But if people want to rent it, they sure can.
Very good.
Yeah, Andy, can you provide a declaration?
Exposition. We're going to do the 1975, I'll call it a classic in my own opinion, The Man Who Would Be King, starring Sean Connery, Michael Caine, and Christopher Plummer.
Nice. So you have seen that, and none of the rest of us have. So this is you choosing that in the hopes of educating us in our film adventures.
Yes.
So that's what this is going to be all about. So we're going to be doing that in between our regular episodes. Each of us is going to have a pick in that. So should be a good time. I'm excited about that. All right. Well, we made it through the Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park. Until the next time with Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Opera, or really just Phantom of the Opera. May the Force be with you.
And also with you.